I didn't know if all of a sudden they were gonna have a flashback because they saw an American face, or I just had no idea what to expect. But after he sat there and looked at me in my eyes for a good minute, and he came over there and he gave me a big hug, and he told me that Vietnam doesn't want war. They don't want to hate the American people, that they just want to live in peace from now on. And
now that I've come and I've been able to put faces, it's been a wonderful experience to get the second side of the story. Every conflict, every problem has two sides. I'd been raised with one side of the story, now I've gotten the second side of the story, and now I can take both those elements and put them together and formulate something to share with my children.
Just like my dad, I'm not going to lie about things when I get back to the United States and try to make it look nice or do anything. All my friends and family and stuff, I'm going to tell them how my trip was.
Once I came to Vietnam, I said, okay, this is more. This is more. This is bigger. This is bigger than Heather. Because a lot of my life was trying to deal with what happened to me. And when I came here and understood that the problem was way, way, way bigger than just me, or just a few of the kids that I had kind of connected with in the United States, I understood that I couldn't go back to just thinking of me and my story and my problems and those things. I knew I had to do more.
The Red Cross estimates that 3 million Vietnamese have been affected by dioxin, including at least 150,000 children born with serious birth defects. Millions of Americans and Vietnamese are still suffering directly and indirectly by the wartime U.S. spraying of Agent Orange and other herbicides over southern and central Vietnam. Question is, how many more generations must suffer, and how long will this deadly legacy of U.S. crimes against innocent lives linger on? Well, that's it, everyone, for this program. Until next time and another Aperture It's, goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Google employees were not only disturbed by the fact that by entering into this agreement with the Zionist regime, their company became directly involved in the Israeli occupation of Palestine, but were equally outraged by the disturbing pattern of militarization that saw similar contracts between Google, Amazon, Microsoft, and other tech giants with the U.S. military, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and other policing agencies. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Ramzi Barut, journalist. This article is published under the heading, "The Billion-Dollar Deal That Made Google and Amazon Partners in Zionist Regime Occupation of Palestine." Here's the story. "We are anonymous because we fear retaliation." This text was part of a letter signed by 500 Google employees last October in which they decried their company's direct support for the Zionist regime and the Zionist regime's military. In this letter, the signatories protested a $1.2 billion contract between Google, Amazon Web Services, AWS, and the Zionist regime, which provides cloud services for the Zionist regime's military and cabinet that allows for further surveillance of an unlawful data collection on Palestinians and facilitates expansion of the Zionist regime's illegal settlements on Palestinian land. This is called Project Nimbus. The project was announced in 2018 and went into effect in May 2021, in the first week of the Zionist regime's war on besieged Gaza, which killed over 250 Palestinians and wounded many more. The Google employees were not only disturbed by the fact that by entering into this agreement with the Zionist regime, their company became directly involved in the Israeli occupation of Palestine, but were equally outraged by the disturbing pattern of militarization that saw similar contracts between Google, Amazon, Microsoft, and other tech giants with the U.S. military, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and other policing agencies. In an article published in the Nation newspaper in June, three U.S. academics have revealed the financial components of Amazon's decision to get involved in such an immoral business, arguing that such military-linked contracts have become a major source of profit for Amazon. It is estimated, according to the article, that AWS alone was responsible for 63% of Amazon's profits in 2020. The maximum people before profit cannot be any more appropriate than in the Palestinian context, and neither Google nor Amazon can claim ignorance. The Zionist regime occupation of Palestine has been in place for decades, and numerous United Nations resolutions have condemned the Zionist regime for its occupation, colonial expansion, and violence against Palestinians. If all of that was enough to wane the enthusiasm of Google and Amazon to engage in projects that specifically aimed at protecting the Zionist regime's security, read Continued Occupation of Palestine, a damning report by Israel's largest human rights group, B'Tselem, should have served as that wake-up call. B'Tselem declared the Zionist regime as an apartheid regime in January 2021. The international rights group Human Rights Watch, HRW, followed suit in April, also denouncing the Zionist regime's apartheid. That was only a few weeks before Project Nimbus was declared. It was as if Google and Amazon were purposely declaring their support of apartheid. The fact that the project was signed during the Zionist regime's war on Gaza speaks volumes about the two tech giants' complete disregards of international law, human rights, and the very freedom of the Palestinian people. It gets worse. On March 15th, hundreds of Google workers signed a petition protesting the firing of one of their colleagues, Ariel Koren, who was active in generating the October letter in protest of Project Nimbus. Koren was the product marketing manager at Google for education and has worked for the company for 6 years. However, she was the kind of employee who was not welcomed by the likes of Google, as the company is now directly involved with various military and security projects. For me, as a Jewish employee of Google, I feel a deep sense of intense moral responsibility, she said in a statement last October, adding, when you work in a company, you have the right to be accountable and responsible for the way that your labor is actually being used, she added. Google quickly retaliated to that seemingly outrageous statement. The following month, her manager presented her with an ultimatum: move to Brazil or lose her position. Eventually, she was driven out of the company. Koren was not the first Google or Amazon employee to be fired for standing up for a good cause, nor would sadly be the last. In this age of militarism, surveillance, unwarranted facial recognition, and censorship, speaking one's mind and daring to fight for human rights and other basic freedoms is no longer an option. Amazon, which stands accused of numerous violations of workers' rights, including its engagement in union busting, is not expected to reverse course anytime soon, especially when so much profits are at stake. But profits generated from market monopoly, mistreatment of workers, or other misconducts are different from profits generated from contributing directly to war crimes and crimes against humanity. Though human rights violations should be shunned everywhere, regardless of their context, the Zionist regime's war on Palestinian people, now with the direct help of such companies, remains one of the gravest injustices that continue to scar the consciousness of humankind. No amount of Google justification or Amazon rationalization can change the fact that they are facilitating the Zionist regime's war crimes in Palestine. To be more precise, according to the Nation, the Google Amazon Cloud Service will help the Zionist regime expand its illegal settlements by supporting data for the Israeli Regime Land Authority, the agency that manages and allocates the land. These settlements, which are repeatedly condemned by the international community, are built on Palestinian land and are directly linked to the ongoing ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people. According to the Zionist regime newspaper Haaretz, Project Nimbus is the most lucrative tender issued by Israel in recent years. The project, which has ignited a secretive war involving top Israeli regime army generals, all vying for a share in the profit, has also whetted the part of the Zionist regime's technology drive, with the ultimate aim of keeping Palestinians entrapped, occupied, and oppressed. This is precisely why the Palestinian boycott movement is absolutely critical, as it targets these international companies, which are migrating to the occupied territories in search of profits. The Zionist regime, on the contrary, should be boycotted, not enabled, sanctioned, and not rewarded. While profit generation is understandably the main goal of companies like Google and Amazon, this goal can be achieved without necessarily requiring the subjugation of a whole people who are currently victims of the world's last remaining apartheid regime.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
U.S. President Joe Biden has stirred up controversy after suggesting that his country could lead the world. Speaking at a business roundtable meeting, Joe Biden referred twice to, quote, a new world order. The phrase quickly became a trending topic on social media on Monday. On the surface, a new world order means a dramatic paradigm shift in international affairs and a change in the balance of power at the global scale. But what the U.S. president didn't consider when uttering those words was the connotation they carry with them. New World Order has for years been used by conspiracy theorists to mean a situation in which a secret cabal of governments take matters into their own hands to form a multinational totalitarian and oppressive regime. Which definition Biden might have been going for is beside the point. The main issue is that he took it upon himself to lead the world. The statement is a fundamental rejection of the world's multipolarity.
We have to always bear in mind that those who are in power, the hegemonic powers of the world, in particular the United States and their European allies, as well as the Zionist entity, they're always planning and always plotting, if you want to use that word, on how to further increase, how to maintain, how to strengthen, how to bolster the power that they already have.
How can the U.S. and its Western allies sideline their rivals, including Russia and China, that are superpowers? The West has been announcing new sanctions against Russia since it began its special military operation into Ukraine. Russia's financial and energy sectors have been under the West's crosshairs.
We are determined to continue to impose costs on Russia to bring about the end of this brutal war.
But Russia was already under sanctions before the conflict even started. This has had many speculating that the West might have been looking for an excuse to increase pressure on Moscow.
These people in power, and I'm talking specifically the United States here, they are trying to get rid of these hurdles, which they consider to be very bothersome impediments to their power projection. So the United States at this moment is trying to completely get rid of the national sovereign powers that still exist in the world. For example, Russia, China, Iran, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, Venezuela, Cuba, you know, all sorts of countries that are refusing to bow down and to accept the globalist world order, these countries are now in particular being targeted.
But such pressure would backfire at those imposing them too. The most basic example is the EU's reliance on Russian energy. At a time when the bloc faces an energy crisis and soaring consumer prices, sanctioning a major producer of gas, oil, and wheat doesn't seem like a sound plan. Russia isn't sitting idly by. Moscow has been planning initiatives to cushion the blow of sanctions on its economy. President Vladimir Putin announced this week that his country has drawn up a list of, quote, unfriendly countries that need to pay for their energy purchases from Russia in rubles, U.S. President Joe Biden entered the Oval Office, promising to bring back diplomacy and to reverse his predecessor's misguided policies. 14 months into his presidency, however, he is following in the footsteps of the Donald Trump administration. How much longer will it take for the U.S. to realize that the unipolar world is no more?
U.S. President Joe Biden has claimed that his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin's back is against the wall and that the Russian leader did not anticipate the strength of NATO's unity in supporting Ukraine. This is despite Ukraine's president Volodymyr Zelensky lashing out on a regular basis against the North Atlantic Alliance's lack of support for his country in the face of Russia's military operation. Nevertheless, Biden claims Russia's accusations that Kiev has biological and chemical weapons means Putin is considering using them himself in the Ukraine conflict. The White House has not provided any evidence to support Biden's claims.
Turn the tables around and begin to accuse the accuser, so to speak. This is a classic case, classic situation. So now they, rather than sort of trying to justify themselves, what these labs were doing there, why were they sponsored, what kind of research they were doing, they turn the tables around and say that Russians want to use it as a pretext for some attack.
A senior American defense official speaking to reporters on condition of anonymity has acknowledged that Washington has no concrete information of a Russian chemical or biological weapons attack. It just happens that Biden's accusation comes after Russian forces stumbled on what Moscow says are U.S.-funded biological research facilities near the Russian border, and asked the White House to explain why it financed a military biological program in Ukraine involving deadly pathogens. It's not the first time America has leveled accusations concerning the use of chemical weapons as a pretext to militarily intervene in other countries. Perhaps the biggest example is the case of Iraq, where American officials presented alleged intelligence that Baghdad was in possession of weapons of mass destruction, which led to the disastrous US-led invasion of Iraq that killed more than 1 million Iraqis. In Syria, Washington and its Western allies claimed the Syrian government used chemical weapons, and America attacked the Arab country despite evidence later emerging that terrorists who the Syrian government had been fighting were the ones who staged the false flag operations. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons even announced the Syrian government's chemical stockpile had been destroyed. There are now concerns Washington will use similar false flag operations in Ukraine.
Really inhumane thing to do. A, you know, it's immoral in terms of kind of lying and trying to blame the other side for your own faults, for your own, you know, sins. But another one, it will just simply escalate the whole thing, because to make this kind of fake attack will probably poison and destroy people, and it will just strengthen Russian resolve and Russian anger.
Biden says that Putin knows there'll be severe consequences because of what he described as a united NATO front, but did not specify what actions the alliance would take. Some cracks have appeared in the NATO alliance, in particular among European countries.
NATO already did all it could. I don't think it will come down, to some kind of exchange of nuclear arms. But I think it's basically we continue in this war of, in the court of public opinion. So the idea and the purpose of the NATO is very simple: to justify their existence, that they're good, they're a force of goodness, as opposed to their opponents, be it Syria, be it Iran, be it Russia. Their opponents are so bad that they are willing to utilize every nasty thing in the book, and that's what we want to do. So it'll be a victory primarily psychological.
In such cases, the issue of timing tends to come up. Biden's remarks come amid peace talks between Ukraine and Russia. The talks haven't been as smooth as many would wish, Nevertheless, there are negotiations which, for some odd reason, the Biden White House is not supporting. And that leads to the question as to why America and some of its Western allies are not backing the ongoing efforts to end this conflict peacefully.
With the conflict between Russia and Ukraine ongoing for over 3 weeks, Turkey is playing a significant role to de-escalate the tensions. The country is hosting high-level discussions between the two sides aimed at reaching a ceasefire, expressing readiness to host talks between the presidents of Ukraine and Russia. In the meantime, reports suggest that the United States has informally suggested that Turkey send its Russian-made S-400 missile defense systems to Ukraine to help Kiev with its fight against Russian forces. The report suggests that American officials have floated the idea with their Turkish counterparts, but no formal request was made. The idea was also mentioned during Deputy State Secretary Wendy Sherman's visit to Turkey earlier this month. That seems too convenient for the U.S. and its Western allies that have been asking Turkey to abandon its Russian-made air defenses and instead use American-made Patriot counterparts.
Yes, it's exactly the same system that they complained about earlier, but the political geometry has changed a little bit, so the United States is trying to turn things around to try and bring Turkey closer and to separate it a little more from Russia and to overcome the debacle for the U.S. that the Turkey's purchase of these missiles created earlier.
Observers say Turkey will almost certainly reject the proposal, but the fact that it's even being offered reveals the West's opportunistic policies. Turkey signed a multi-billion-dollar agreement to acquire several batteries of Russia's S-400 missile defense system in 2017. The West wasn't pleased with the deal, arguing that installing such systems in a NATO country would potentially compromise the security of the military alliance, as well as pose a risk to the newly developed F-35 fighter jets. The first batch of the Russian-made system was delivered to Turkey in 2019, enraging the West. Former U.S. President Donald Trump imposed sanctions on Turkey over the incident and cut Ankara, a financial and manufacturing partner, from the F-35 program. Turkey has demanded repayment of some $1.4 billion it put into the program, but so far hasn't received anything back. Turkey stresses that it opted for the Russian system as the Western-made counterparts were not offered to it at agreeable terms. The U.S. suggestion that Ankara send its S-400 missile defense system to Ukraine to shoot down Russian fighter jets, apart from the technical hurdles of delivering and installing them, would potentially risk a Russian blowback. Washington has certainly predicted that any deterioration of ties between Ankara and Moscow could harm Turkey's position as a neutral broker and derail the ceasefire talks. That raises some serious questions about the U.S. stated willingness to end the conflict in Ukraine as soon as possible.
The spokesman for Yemen's armed forces, Brigadier General Yahya Sari', says Sana'a has staged a fresh retaliatory operation against the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in a bid to break the all-out blockade Riyadh has imposed on its southern neighbor. Yahya Sari' noted that targets in Saudi Arabia's port city of Jeddah, as well as Jizan, have been struck in the third phase of special operations. Earlier, Sari announced the second phase, saying Yemeni forces had conducted major operations, which he described as special in nature, and that the mission had been carried out successfully. He pointed out the large-scale operation has been staged with a batch of ballistic missiles and drones. According to the spokesman, Phase 2 involved projectiles flying across the border, targeting a number of vital and sensitive sites in the regions of Abha, Khamis Umshayat, Jizan, and Samata, as well as southern Tehran, with facilities belonging to Saudi oil giant Aramco among the sites targeted. Saudi state media acknowledged a barrage of drone and missile attacks. Despite the kingdom claiming to have intercepted the projectiles, it later reported that drones had hit a petroleum distribution terminal, a natural gas plant, and an oil refinery that led to a temporary reduction in the refinery's production levels. On March 11, Surrey announced the first phase of this operation, which also included the bombing of a number of vital and sensitive Saudi facilities affiliated with Aramco in Riyadh, among other areas. He has stressed that the operations come within the framework of Yemen's legitimate right to respond to what he labeled as an unjust siege. According to UN experts, the Saudi-led blockade on Yemen is having a catastrophic effect on millions of people.
The Yemenis have suffered a lot because they cannot import even food or medicine. And the past 70 years have been hell to the Yemenis. And it is now seven painful years for them, and the world is just watching.
Saria has pledged that the Yemeni armed forces will carry out more military operations in the not-so-distant future to break the siege, warning Riyadh the upcoming retaliatory attacks will include sensitive targets that are beyond the imagination of the Saudis. The Saudi war on Yemen is on the brink of its seventh anniversary. On March 26, 2015, Riyadh and a number of its regional allies, backed by the United States, declared war on Yemen. Riyadh said the offensive would take a couple of weeks to achieve its goals, one of which was to restore the former government in Sana'a, whose term had expired but was loyal to the Saudis. However, 7 years later, analysts say the kingdom and its allies, including Washington, have underestimated the determination and the steadfastness of the Yemeni forces and nation to seek sovereignty from Saudi rule. In normal warfare, Saudi Arabia would have the upper hand in this war. Riyadh enjoys unwavering support from the West, in particular the United States. Washington has provided logistical and intelligence backing to the Saudi Air Force, while the UK has trained Saudi pilots. But the real support has come in the form of arms sales. America and its Western allies have sold the Saudis advanced weapons to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars, making a massive profit. Despite warnings by rights groups of Western complicity in war crimes amid an indiscriminate Saudi bombardment campaign that has killed women and children, Western weapons continue to flow into the kingdom. Despite all this support, the question is, after 7 years, why can't Saudi Arabia win its war on Yemen?
They do not have legitimate goals by waging the war. Number two, their people, their soldiers have become demoralized because of their inability to score victories over the Yemenis. And thirdly, the Yemenis are known historically for their power.
Under a tight blockade, Yemeni forces have manufactured their own indigenous ballistic missiles and drones. Despite their relatively low costs in comparison with Saudi weapons, they have proven very effective. Yemeni officials say they have no choice but to expand retaliatory operations against targets deep inside Saudi Arabia, with the goal of forcing Riyadh to end its blockade and to end its air raids. Thank you.
felicitations at the beginning of a new Iranian year, Nowruz. Congratulations to everyone at the start of spring and revival of nature.
الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
All great economic decisions should be defined on the basis of the economy of resistance. Imagine that we sign a financial or industrial contract with such and such a country. It should become clear where in the economy of resistance this contract is situated. If we think that the economic improvement of the country is achieved only through foreign investment, this is a mistake. Of course, foreign investment is a good thing. But it fills in only one of the blanks on the table. What is more important than foreign investment in activating domestic capacities? We have many dormant capacities that should be activated. This is more important. Of course, foreign investment is necessary to exist alongside. But if we make everything dependent on foreign investment, this is also a mistake.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Sometimes it is said that they bring new technologies with them. Very well. This is all right. We agree with bringing in new technologies, of course, if they really do so. However, even if they do not bring them, as I have said before, can our youth, who have made achievements in the area of nanotechnology, in the nuclear area, and in the area of building complicated technologies, and who have helped Iran to be among the first of 5 to 10 countries in the world in many areas, not do something to make our oil wells produce more oil? Can they not improve our oil refineries? Or can they not improve the other areas which need to be improved and in which we need foreign technology? Certainly, if this technology is transferred during our transactions with foreigners, this is all right with us, and we do not have any objections. Notice that today, meticulous analysts who work on economic and political matters of the world bet on our country's economy of resistance. The issue is of which such great importance and sensitivity. They argue and bet on whether the economy of resistance that Iran has brought up will or will not produce results. It is of such tremendous importance. Therefore, this defines our independence. This was the third criterion that we discussed. Allah, I wanna feel-
grace that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
In yet another act of Israeli aggression against the Palestinians of Gaza, Israeli planes sprayed toxic chemicals on the eastern perimeter of the coastal enclave. Israeli crop duster planes sprayed herbicides at least twice this week on Gaza farming areas. The Israeli regime regularly sprays Palestinian agricultural lands near the so-called buffer zone with dangerous substances which destroy the crops. For more than a decade, Israeli planes sprayed Gaza's farmlands several times a year, destroying various crops.
The Israelis spread herbicides to the farmers' land beside the border in order to prevent them to plant in their land, to bush the farmers out of their land and leave their land without any trees in order to feed them for their food security and for their children.
Spraying unknown toxic substances on Gaza's farmlands may have long-lasting effects on the environment. Gazan farmers say they are struggling to make ends meet due to Israel's inhumane practices.
Israel sprays our farmlands with poison. The chemicals that they spray don't kill the weed on the fence. They only kill our crops. We suffer heavy losses when Israel sprays our land because it's killing our crops and poisoning our farmlands.
Israel claims that it sprays what it described as weed killers for security reasons, but experts say the Israeli regime aims to destroy the livelihoods of farmers.
Using such herbicides on Gaza Strip by the Israelis, it's kind of offensive towards the Palestinian farmers. At the same time, towards the Palestinian food security, these areas are feeding the Palestinians with the needed vegetables and other kinds.
Rights groups say the suffering of farmers and their families in Gaza reflects the scope of Israeli human rights violations. Gazan farmers have been hit hard by the Israeli blockade and wars since 2007. Now experts say that Israel's poisoning of crops will make a bad situation worse and harm vital sources of food in the territory. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
As the world's eyes are on the Russia-Ukraine conflict, the Saudi led war in Yemen is still taking the lives of more civilians and pushing the country to the brink of famine. A recent UN report says 17.4 million Yemenis are food insecure, and the number is likely to go up to 19 million by the end of the year.
Unfortunately, the United Nations reports did not clarify the main reason for the deterioration of the humanitarian situation in Yemen, which is the blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia and its allies. The only solution to end the humanitarian crisis is to lift the siege and allow Yemenis to import food and medicine.
Back in 2015, Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war in Yemen to bring back to power former President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi. Hundreds of thousands of people, including women and the children, have lost their lives since then.
I was sitting in my house with my children in the evening, and suddenly a missile struck the next house. The explosion destroyed my house as well. We were so afraid.
Saudi warplanes targeted our neighborhood. Look at the destruction. This is a crime, and unfortunately, the world's watching in silence.
The Saudi war has impacted all aspects of civilian lives in Yemen, including the healthcare system, which is on the verge of collapse. This comes amid the ongoing fuel shortage, as Saudi Arabia keeps detaining Yemeni oil ships despite the fact that the vessels have UN permits.
We suffer from a severe lack of fuel. We cannot operate medical devices without electricity, not to mention the lack of medicines and medical solutions. There is overcrowding in the medical centers. Unfortunately, the United Nations did not provide us with anything other than media statements. The international community must stop Saudi Arabia from seizing Yemeni oil ships.
Children are the most affected people by Saudi Arabia's war. The rate of child malnutrition is one of the highest in the world, and the situation continues to deteriorate.
More than a million children are suffering from malnutrition in Yemen, and I believe the number is greater than this. And we are coming to a worse period because we do not have the most basic needs necessary to save the lives of sick children, such as milk, solutions, and medicines.
Observers say the years-long Saudi war in Yemen has only created the world's worst man-made humanitarian crisis. They say years of failure should be enough for Riyadh to start looking for other means to get rid of the quagmire it is stuck with its war in Yemen. Al-Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
On Thursday, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian arrived in Beirut to hold talks with Lebanese officials. Abdollahian expressed his country's willingness to provide aid to Lebanon in different fields, especially in the economic and commercial sectors.
Almost a month ago, I met with Lebanese Prime Minister Najib Mirati in the Munich summit, and I informed him about the Islamic Republic of Iran's readiness to assist Lebanon in building two power plants, where each would provide 1,000 megawatts of electricity. This is in addition to Tehran's readiness to cooperate with Lebanon in economic development and other fields.
Abdollahian met with top Lebanese officials to discuss bilateral ties as well as latest developments in the region. President Michel Aoun stressed during his meeting with the Iranian minister that any progress in the Vienna talks as well as negotiations between Iran and Saudi Arabia will have positive impacts on the region and the world. During his talks with Lebanese Parliament Speaker Nabih Berri and Prime Minister Mikati, Abdollahian touched upon the significance of the upcoming parliamentary elections in Lebanon. As Lebanon is dealing with economic crisis, some experts believe U.S. bans on any dealing with other Asian states, especially Iran, has exacerbated Lebanon's problems.
The U.S. pressure and Western country against the Iranian commitment to help Lebanese people in supporting their living, of daily living, this is what prevents the Lebanese government from receiving the funds and the support of the Iranian people and Iranian government. As people and as local authorities in Ghubairi, we welcome for any support coming from the Iranian people, first of all, and the Iranian government for the sake of better survival.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah also held a meeting with the Iranian minister where they discussed developments in Lebanon and the region. Abdollahian met with Palestinian factions and reiterated Iran's support for the full liberation of Palestine. The Iranian foreign minister has reiterated the Islamic Republic of Iran's previous calls to build two electricity stations, which could substantially resolve Lebanon's energy crisis. However, Lebanese officials seem reluctant to face U.S. intimidations and work with Iran, or even China for that matter, to change Lebanon's dire conditions. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Due to the conflict in Ukraine and Western sanctions against Russia, it has never been more costly to buy essential food items in the European Union, and the situation is set to get much worse. The world's biggest wheat producer is Russia. The third largest is Ukraine.
Wheat is a very good example. When I say wheat, we are actually talking about bread to feed people.
In fact, wheat prices have risen by 70%. The European Commission has just unveiled plans to support food producers and reduce tax to 0% on certain food items. €330 million has been announced to support Ukrainian farmers.
They need, for the spring sowing campaign, they need 50,000 tons of fuel per week.
Animal feed stocks are on the decline. Campaigners say millions could starve in East Africa if EU leaders don't do more to help poorer nations. Syria and Yemen have also been singled out for needing special support.
There are, in fact, 14 low-income countries which depend for more than 50% of their wheat imports on these two countries, on Ukraine and Russia.
The European Commission has presented new legislation to make it mandatory for member states to ensure 80% gas reserves are put in place before November. Experts say that is wishful thinking. 3.5 million Ukrainian refugees have now arrived in the EU. Most countries in the bloc have failed to take in their fair share, but some already have.
Poland is in top. The country number two is Austria. The country number three is Cyprus. Country number four is Czech Republic.
Almost 3.5 billion euro has been set aside from the EU budget to support refugees, including 1,470 unaccompanied children who have arrived in the bloc from Ukraine. Some nations are saying it's simply not enough money. EU leaders will hold a summit here on Thursday and Friday to consider, amongst other things, a request from Poland for new funding towards the cost of dealing with the growing refugee crisis. All indications so far suggest that request will be rejected. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Over the past week in France, social unrest has been a near daily occurrence. But it may be an everyday issue now and until after the presidential election. Public transport unions in Paris have called an unlimited strike starting March 25th over rampant inflation. Reduced purchasing power was the number one election issue in 2017 and 2012, but the unrest in Ukraine and the European Union's response to it has sent costs haywire. The increases arrive after a decade of right-wing austerity measures, which suppressed wages, reduced social services, and decreased job stability, leaving the average person especially vulnerable to record-high prices. Across the nation, unions were already protesting in an immediate response to President Emmanuel Macron's promise to raise the retirement age to 65. It's a bold gambit, given how unpopular such a change would be. But Macron appears to be betting that polls are correct and that he'll win re-election.
Plenty of people die before the age of 65. Can they never retire? Plenty of workers have physically demanding jobs and are poorly paid. Should they live in poverty and work until their death as well? 65 is way too late, and it's another step too far by Macron.
Austerity, then the coronavirus, now the Ukraine-related instability. Many say France is on the brink of a return to yellow vest levels of unrest if more far-right economic policies are demanded of the average person, but not of the rich.
Raising the retirement age is a certain way to reduce the number of available jobs. So from an economic point of view, not only would this not solve our unemployment problems, but it will actually be counterproductive. Macron is doing things from a purely ideological perspective and not at all with a view of helping the people of France.
France's presidential election has been dominated by disinterest. Voters have tuned out a campaign which was based on Islamophobia and xenophobia, and then the unrest in faraway Ukraine. Many wonder if Macron's call to raise the retirement age may have awoken a sleeping giant, the French public.
France seems to be ignoring or has forgotten about the presidential election, but regular protests are reminding the country of the long-running domestic issues which France still faces. Some of the answers may be fought out in the streets over the next month. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
A delegation from the International Academic Campaign Against Occupation and Apartheid headed to the offices of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, OHCHR, as well as the UN Special Coordinator's Office, UNSCO, in Gaza. They handed the memorandum on Israeli apartheid signed by around 70 international organizations, human rights networks, academics, and researchers from 45 countries. The campaign is calling on the United Nations and Western countries to impose sanctions on the Israeli regime for its occupation of the Palestinian territories and its apartheid regime. The Israeli regime is an occupying power and has kept the Gaza Strip under a crippling blockade since 2007 and also waged four wars on the tiny enclave.
We are here to condemn Israeli apartheid, and we call on the international community to support the Palestinian people. We also demand and end the Israeli crimes. Israeli leaders must face justice for their crimes against the Palestinian people.
Tel Aviv also practices apartheid policies against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Among Israel's apartheid policies is the demolition of Palestinian homes in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Israel also keeps thousands of Palestinian prisoners in its jails under inhumane detention conditions. Israeli forces also use excessive force to kill and maim peaceful Palestinian protesters in the blockaded Gaza Strip as well as in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds.
Today we are here to prove that the crimes of the occupations against the Palestinians and the prisoners must be documented and to support the Palestinians to obtain their rights.
Last month, at least 277 human rights groups and civil society organizations around the world denounced Israeli officials for imposing apartheid on Palestinians.
Observers say that Israel's apartheid against Palestinians is a cruel system of domination that constitutes a crime against humanity. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian arrived in Damascus heading a high-ranking delegation. He met with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and discussed the implementation of bilateral cooperation agreements. Talks covered cooperation in fighting terrorism, in which Abdullahian renewed Iran's support to Syria for the full liberation of all its territories. The top diplomat briefed President Assad on the Vienna talks on the revival of the JCPOA. Assad hailed Iran for adhering to principles and rights in the track adopted during the negotiations. He asserted that reaching a deal has become more important in service of Iran and the region's interest as well as international equilibrium.
We had good meetings with President Assad and Foreign Minister Faisal Maqtad. We welcome the new approach by some Arab states in restoring relations with Syria. We reaffirmed Iran's readiness to develop relations with Syria and discuss increasing the level of tourist exchange. We hope that in the near future, the presidents of both countries would meet.
A separate meeting was also held between the foreign ministers of Syria and Iran. Focus was laid on the notable increase of trade exchange and means of overcoming the impact of economic sanctions on the two countries.
We discussed means of confronting unilateral illegal sanctions on both states as well as developments currently happening in the meetings of the Syrian Constitutional Committee in Geneva. Syria and Iran's stances are identical in this regard. We are in favor of a successful result. However, the other side is not working for national interests.
Syria was the first destination of the regional tour of the Iranian delegation, which also includes Lebanon. Abdullahian's visit is one of many exchanged between both countries' officials. It signals the extensive and continuous cooperation between the two allies at all times, which resulted in a defeat of terror in Syria and currently aims to boost economic partnerships. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Poland's support for fellow Europeans fleeing Ukraine is receiving much praise. However, this has been a huge turnaround, for in past years, the Eastern European country has been heavily criticized for a proud anti-immigration stance, particularly hostile towards Muslim refugees.
Angela Merkel started this madness, and now this is a problem about Muslims mainly coming to Europe.
Amid the anti-Islam rhetoric, Press TV decided to investigate how local Muslims live under these types of challenges.
The Muslim community that lives here in Poland is small but very passionate. It's estimated somewhere between 25 to 40,000 Muslims currently live in the country, making up about 0.1% of the current population, as it's estimated. The majority of them are native Tatars, but also there has been an immigration of Muslims to Poland from various countries. We've come here to one of the main mosques in the capital, Warsaw, to meet the community firsthand.
The imam explains that his main focus has always been to re-educate Poles about Islam and demonstrate Islamic teachings through good deeds.
We teach Quran, we teach Arabic language, and we teach something about Islam. Yes. During Ramadan, because Ramadan is near now, we're making soon 1992, we're making food and iftar for everybody, every day. From time to time, also, we're making open day. This is for un-Muslims to come to our mosque to hear something and listen.